So, I figured the first couple of things we'll just talk in just very broad strokes, some of the basic concepts of Kabbalah, whether they, how they apply, do they apply, etc. And then we'll, you can see the subtitles here, Fear of Study, the idea of 40 years old, what's the Zohar, and then using things that you learned with Kabbalah, using it and applying it to practical halacha. So the basic story of the world, according to Kabbalah, actually starts like this. The way I once tried to explain it, I think it makes the most sense to myself, is that the Torah, what you call it, well, we'll see. And then and we'll see what really are the qualifications, and then you'll judge for yourself.
Okay.
The Torah is what we call Torah's Nigla. I mean, the Torah that we learn, which is most of the things that appear on the bookshelves in this room, Torah's Nigla, open Torah, is the way that we perceive the world, and that we perceive halacha, and that we perceive HaKadosh Baruch Hu's relationship to the world. Torah's Hanister, we refer to as Kabbalah and Kabbalistic comments, concepts, is the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu perceives the world. So while we perceive the world as being a place of cities and countries and land and water and people do things and people do mitzvahs, etc., HaKadosh Baruch Hu is seeing it perhaps as growths of Kedusha and different spheres that are moving to one another. And that's what you look. That's because you're looking at it from a different perspective. And I think that like is somewhat helpful to try to understand what the distinction is. I don't remember if I saw that anywhere, heard that anywhere, or made it up myself.
That's a very basic kind of thing to state, that we're defining the way Hashem is seeing the world, even if it's different than the way.
Okay, is the fact that it's basic, is that good or bad?
I don't know, but I don't know that we. I guess my question is,
said anything yet, so you have time to ask your question.
Thank you.
The world according to Kabbalah, the world according to us, so we can look in Bereshis and we see how the world was created. It started from nothing, or it's Tohu Vavohu, not from nothing, but from Tohu Vavohu, and then there became people, and the people had to figure out how to navigate this world. The world according to Kabbalah is that at the beginning there wasn't nothing, there was everything. There was what we call Ein Sof, that there was the HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is the be-all and end-all, the beer. I think one of my first shiurim here that we did is God Sleep In on Sunday mornings, we talk about the beer, B-E-E-R, right? Beer, the one who bees. That is that perhaps is one of the best descriptions of Hashem. However, in order to... If God is the perfect being, so can God ever improve, right? That's one of the questions I want to ask, right? Can God make a rock he can't push, right? Is that it? Can God make a rock he can't push, right? That is the mashal. So to here, if God is considered perfect, can God improve? So how can God possibly improve? So God, so to speak, constrains himself or created space. That's the concept that's known as tzimtzum, right? From that light, he created a space that wasn't all light. That light was all contracted into a specific vessel. That vessel exploded into various what we call klipos, right? And there are those klipos, the sparks of light are all over the world. And you hear this Hasidish concept of klipos. That's what it's referring to. We're supposed to recover these klipos, find these klipos wherever they may be, and bring them back into the world so that the entire world is lit again. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has, so to speak, improved himself. I mean, that's the game of life, so to speak. Right?
Can improved we, himself?
Well, God has improved himself. How does God improve the perfection? Through us, right? If we have the ability to do good, if we have the ability to bring back this light, so to speak, right? So then we have done the improvement on behalf of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, and we are the representatives of Hashem. We have neshamas within us, right? And that is the idea of that's what we're trying to do in this world. So I didn't go into a Kabbalistic text to find a nice way of phrasing this. So I went to Rabbi Ziegler, who has put together work on Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik talks about the concept of tzimtzum in Halachic Man. In Halachic Man, he discusses tzimtzum, and he compares the Halachic Man's approach to a Kabbalistic Man's approach, and he summarized right here. In the blue book appears on the shelf of Majesty and Humility, He says one way of bringing God into the world is by means of halachic cognition or Talmud Torah. The other is by means of halachic action or shmiras hamitzvos. To elaborate on these ideas, we must introduce the rosh presentation of the doctrine of Kabbalistic notion tzimtzum or divine contraction in Kabbalah. And note that the Kabbalist is a type of homo religiosus. Tzimtzum is a tragedy. Right? That before, he spells it out, before the creation of the universe, God filled all of existence, so to speak. Since nothing finite can exist within the infinite, God had to contract his existence in order to make room for the world. The mystic sees the existence of the world as a type of affront, heaven forbid, to God's glory. The cosmos, as it were, impinges upon the infinity of the Creator. And the fact that we exist, the fact that the world exists, means that God is not existing in God's fullest capacity. So therefore, the Kabbalist is going to see the world somewhat sadly. That is why Rabbi Kenny Brander has the story that he was one of the last weddings that Rav Soloveitchik was ever Masada Kedushin for, and he did the wedding, and then he was going to leave. He didn't stay for dancing. He was an old man already, and Rabbi Brander said that he told him, you know, hopefully we'll be able to share many happy occasions in the future, and we'll, you know, have verses and shalom zachars and etc. And the Rav turned to him and said, yes, but if you have a shalom zachar, make sure not to serve chickpeas. And like that was it, and then he left. So probably what pshat is this distinction, right? What is the idea of serving chickpeas at a shalom zachar? Is that the shalom zachar represents a sort of mourning? Could represent a sort of mourning that the baby was living in the perfect world. The baby knew the entire Torah, right? And therefore we are mourning the fact that that has been lost. So Rav Soloveitchik was telling him that that's not our perception of the world. I mean, halachic man's perception of the world is that, no, there's no reason to mourn. Now the child has an opportunity to do mitzvos. So do we look at that as nebuch, we're stuck doing mitzvos because God is not all present? Or we're saying that we have the opportunity to mitzvos, and that's very exciting and wonderful and all the good things in this world. So that is the comparison, that is one way of to compare and contrast a Kabbalistic view of the world versus a... halachic approach to the world. Okay? So that is idea number one. The idea, that is big, big Kabbalistic concept number one, tzimtzum. Kabbalistic concept number two is this idea of spheres. So you probably have all seen that image before. Probably don't have much idea of what it means. It's okay. I don't really have much of an idea of what it means either. But it means something along the lines of those 10 spheros represent these klipos that when this light shattered and went all over the world. So it's represented in this way. And this is the order to recovery. How it is the order to recovery and how all these words mean. So I remember I once went through it and kind of worked it out. But it is, you know, not something that I can share or review or try to figure out once again without putting in a lot of effort. That's what the concept is. I mean, we see that image around a lot. If you go to the Wikipedia page on Kabbalah, that is the picture you see, as that represents the idea of growth along these lines. I mean, we generally, I say we as a so to speak a Litvak, someone who learned in yeshiva and spends most of his days learning halacha, right, perceive the world as that we relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through doing mitzvos and learning Torah, right? Another approach is that as one climbs this ladder, that's really a way of climbing this ladder, and this ladder is really what represents the closest to Hashem. So they'll say, yeah, you think you feel close to Hashem when you do mitzvos. It's not really the mitzvos, it's rather because of the midos and klipos and sparks and all that stuff which you're uncovering when you're doing the mitzvos. Okay? So that's halakhic concept number two.
What is the structure, the shape, this form?
Keter is the highest.
Okay, but it's supposed to be a ladder, okay.
Yeah.
So this is...
What do you think, Malchus is the lowest?
I believe so.
But when you do Spheros Omer, it goes up towards Malchus.
Yeah, it
goes up towards Malchus. Yeah, that's true. Now I'm not sure. Okay.
But there's 10 here. There's 7.
Yeah, it's only 7.
No, there's only 10 within, right, 7 within sphere, but there's 10 here. Yes, these are the 10 spheros. Okay, and then there's this whole, usually in Kabbalistic thought, you'll come across these things about letters and gematrios and this word and that word and what they mean. Yeah. So putting together letters and putting together words is a very important concept. And that's found in the Gemara. A lot of these concepts one can find a source for in the Gemara. There's a famous Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin, Amar Rava, Ibai Tzadiki Baru Alma, Right? Rava said, if the righteous desire it, they can create the world. For it's written, but your iniquities have distinguished. Okay. Rava baragavra. Rava actually created a man. Right? Shadre lakame de Rabbi Zera. And he sent this man to Rabbi Zera. And it seems from this Gemara that he didn't actually, he didn't tell Rabbi Zera about this. He just, sent this guy over to Rabbi Zera to see what would happen. So, hava kamishtai behedya, velo havi kamahadrlai. So, Rabbi Zera wishes him a shalom aleichem, and the guy doesn't answer. Right? So, amar lei, man chavriat hadar liefrecha. So he said, oh, you're a creature by the magicians, you're going to return to dust. Meaning you're clearly not a real person, otherwise you would talk back to me. Right? So clearly this is what we refer to in common language as a golem. Right? You were created by somebody who was able to use these letters and use this stuff, but you weren't able to, you're not all the way, and you're a golem. Rav Chanina and Rav Oshia spent we'll just read it in Hebrew. Rav Chanina and Rav Oshia, Havu Yasei Komale Shabta V'Aski B'Sefer Yetzira, they spent all of Shabbos and Sefer Yetzira, the oldest of the Kabbalistic text, allegedly. Umivr Luhu Igla Tilsa V'Achile. And they made a egel, a calf, that is one third of its growth, and they ate it. That is the best kind of calf, one that is one third of its growth, apparently. So they were able to create this, and they were able to eat it. Sounds like on Shabbos, right? They just created and ate it, which raises a whole host of questions, right? In terms of halacha.
They can create it.
Right? How did that? Right? They created cooked also. There is a tshuva from the Chacham Tzvi, right? Rav Yaakov Emden spoke about this past Shabbos. Rav Yaakov Emden plays a big role in a lot of this stuff. Rav Yaakov Emden's father was a Chacham Tzvi, so he apparently has a tshuva on the topic. Fascinating, Shuvas. One of the shakashas is, can a golem be counted for a minion? Right? And he brings a proof from the Gemara in Brachos where they only have 9 people and they need a 10th, and one of the Tanaim are there, and his slave is there. So his slave didn't count for the minion, so he frees his slave in order so the slave could count for a minion. So that raises a bunch of questions because.
That's why you had to convert all your slaves anyway.
Eventually. But there is a problem of freeing slaves. You're not really supposed to. What do you mean he'll have to feel? What do you mean he'll have to feel?
I thought you had to convert all your non-Jewish slaves to Judaism. Well, have them in your household.
This was an Eved Ivri, I think, even. I think they're just not Chayiv. It was the Eved Ivri or Eved Kanani? He was Eved... What?
I guess like the Eved Kanani, when he comes free...
He was Tevi Avzi. Tevi.
Yeah, he's not Jewish.
He wasn't Jewish. Okay, so he was an Eved Kanani. So you convert him on the spot if he counted for the minion. Right? So the Rechachot says, so you see from here that a golem can't count for a minion.
Because?
Why? Because by freeing the slave, that's a prohibition. You're not really supposed to free slaves. Right? That you're being meshachar as a eved, right? You're not supposed to free slaves until one needs to. So why did he violate that? So the Gemara has to raise a question. Why did he do that? He's allowed to do it because it was a mitzvah shebarabim and other people were going to gain, etc. But if a golem counted for a minion, it would have been a lot easier for him to just make a golem, right? So the haraya, that's the proof that a golem doesn't count for a minion. Okay. So that is part of the issue. That's part of the issue of putting letters together for the purposes of to do all these really neat things. Okay.
How do you know the golem is Jewish?
How do you know a golem is
he's
Jewish?
He's not Jewish. He's not
well, maybe it's not.
But you'd have to convert the
The kasha but the question is, can it count for a minion? And the answer is no, either because it's not Jewish or because it doesn't count for a minion because it's not human. But either way, the answer is still the same. Okay, so one of the famous issues when it comes to Kabbalah is that somehow everybody seems to be afraid to study. There's some kind of issue or fear of, are we supposed to be learning it? Is we're not supposed to be learning it, etc. So that has firm basis in the Mishnah and Torahs. In Torah Hanigla, the Mishnah in the beginning of the second parak of Chagiga tells the following: Ein dorshin ba'arayos b'shalusha. One is not supposed to give shir to arayos with in the presence of three. Meaning, I believe a teacher and two students is what is. No, that's a problem. A teacher and two students is a problem. It really should be taught one-on-one. The laws of who's allowed to marry who. So the Gemara discussed that. Why? What are we so afraid of? The answer is because we're afraid that the student might get it wrong, right? So he says, well, what's the problem? It's only 1 to 2. Right? The guy will get it, or he won't, or you'll ask him. He says, no, because when you're talking to one, the other guy's going to nod off, and he's not going to follow everything you're saying, and there's a big fear that he's going to mess up and marry a person he's not supposed to marry. So therefore, arayos, who one is going to marry and who one isn't, shouldn't be taught in large groups, it should be taught privately. Okay. V'lo b'maisa b'reishis b'shnayim, v'lo b'merkava b'yachid. right? And the Maisa Bereishis shouldn't even be taught in two, it sounds like. Right, the Maisa Bereishis is referring to the obviously the creation of the world and all the concepts included there. V'lo b'merkava b'yachid. What is the Merkava? That's referring to the Maisa Merkava, the description of the chariot, the description of the throne room of Hashem. We've learned a kind of hints to that in Daniel, but it's really found in Yeshaya, or Yecheskel. Yecheskel, and there's a hint of it in Yeshaya. But right, Yecheskel is really the main thing that they are referring to. And that shouldn't be learned. Elaim kein haya chacham umeven midaito. Until he is a chacham and he understands things. Okay, and then give some also Kabbalistic. But that's good enough for our Mishnah, for what we need to know. So there is some kind of issue, and it's clear in the Mishnayos already, and this is quoted lahalacha, that there is a fear of learning. What are we afraid of? So that Gemara, which is about four dafim in Chagiga that talks about these Kabbalistic concepts, what is the Maisa Merkava, what does it mean? Right. Then the Gemara goes on to describe some of these things, right? But one of the things, so what are we nervous about? So it tells the following story. So Tanu Rabbanan, Arba Nichnasu Bepardes. That there were four Tanayim that went into the garden. So the Pardes represents a closeness to closest to Hashem, meaning they went to learn Kabbalah. Ve'iluhein, Ben Zazai, Ben Zoma, Acher, and Rabbi Akiva. Okay. So Amar Lehem, Rabbi Akiva said to them, Keshetem Magim, Eitzel Avne Sheyesh Tahor. Sheish tahor ashayish. When you get to the marble stones, right, that are pure, al tomru mayimayim. You shouldn't shout out. You shouldn't say water. Okay. Mishum shenamar dover shkarim lo yichavin leneged einai. For it says he speaks falsehood shall not be established before mine eyes. Okay. So what happens to these people? So Ben Azai hates tzumes. So Ben Azai takes a look, he dies, and it gives a pasuk about him. Ben Zom. At what he saw in Pardes.
I see.
Okay. That was Ben Azai. Ben Zoma hates its Venifka. So Ben Azai takes a look and he goes nuts. He becomes
Ben Zoma.
I said Ben Zoma. I'm sorry. Ben Zoma, he goes insane. Okay. Acher kitzets benetios. Acher, right, who is Elisha ben Avuya. So he starts cutting the branches. And Rabbi Akiva yatsa b'shalom. And Rabbi Akiva goes out unhurt. So who had a successful sojourn into Pardes? Well, that might be debatable. How many people here? We know one person was unsuccessful, right? We assume Acher became an Apikoros, right? He became a heretic based on what he saw. Rabbi Akiva seemed to be fine. And you have these two in the middle that either Ben Zoma went crazy, Ben Azai took a look and he died. Okay, but it had some kind of effect on them, right? So what was it? So I think a couple of years ago when we gave that Rabbi Akiva series, so I think we gave a whole shiur on this Gemara and we explained how all four, why all four was the natural reaction to other things that we see in Shas. I remember I found some article then. I found the source sheet, but I didn't find the article. But whatever, there's what to be said about all of it. But the fear, the regular fear, the fear of Acher, let's say becoming an Apikoros, the most obvious fear is that the perspective of the world through Kabbalah's eyes is that the world God is filling the light is filling up the world, right? That no matter what you do, the world is spiritually growing. The question for a person is, are you on the good side of that? Are you on the bad side of that? Are you going to experience the pleasure of that? Are you going to experience the pain through that? But either way, it's happening. So if that's the case, that sounds a lot like something called pantheism. Right? The fear is that if everything is kadosh and everything is holy, and therefore every act could be considered holy, so then it doesn't make a difference what I do anymore, because everything is in fact bringing holiness, so to speak, into the world. Right, so that could lead to pantheism. Right? The reason why we're not pantheistic, David Aaron has coined the term, I think he coined the term, unless anyone else did before him, something called panentheism, where he says that it's in between monotheism and pantheism is what we really believe in. Monotheism is that there's a belief in God and we're separate from God. Pantheism means that there's a God and everything is subsumed within God. And panentheism means that there is a God and we are on one hand connected to God, on the other hand separated from God. On one hand we have a neshama and everything we do is aligned with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. On the other hand, we also have Bechira Chafshis, and we have the ability to choose about whether we are going to align ourselves in that way or not. But either way, the message of God's world is going to come in. I think the mashal we gave in the past is the person, maybe, I think most of the people here would recall, the guy who goes on a business trip and the first time he goes away for a day. Well, he's got to make a living, so he goes away for a day. Then he goes away for a week. All right, he got to make a living, goes away for a week. Then he goes away for 4 months, right? So by the time he gets back, his wife is wants a divorce, and one kid is and his kids are all off the derech, and everything has gone bad. What happened there, right? So he had to teach the world a choice between, we'll say, family values or the importance of earning a living. So when you go for a day, so okay, there's an importance to earning a living. When you go for a week, okay, there's an importance to earning a living. When you go for 4 months, so which of his values took precedence, right? So is it earning a living or is it teaching the idea of teaching family values? But either way, when the dust settles, what did he teach the world? He taught the world the value of family values. Right, that ultimately family needs to trump earning a living. Right, so he had a choice. He could either teach that message by going the family value way, in which case he would have brought that message into the world and still had a wife and kids, or he could teach that by not going the other way and showing the importance by being on the other side. So he is suffering as a decision, but yet the message was still brought into the world, so to speak. Okay, that is the. That is the idea there. Okay, so if we look...
You can always be used as a bad example.
Hmm?
You can always be used as a bad example.
You can always be used... Right. Oh, good. Okay, is that like a saying that people like...
Everybody's worth something because they can always be used as a bad example.
Good. All right, I'll remember that for funerals sometime. okay, so in Shulchan Aruch, what does it say about all this? So Shulchan Aruch... So Shulchan Aruch has the idea that we, how we divide our day in terms of our learning. That is the idea of the third, the third, the third. Right? That way, he's mostly quoting the Rambam here. Right? A third Mikra, a third Mishnah, a third Talmud, and what does that mean? And then perhaps when one gets older and more advanced, they could go a little bit more the Talmud route because it really contains everything. So that's what this halach in Shulchan Aruch is. Comes the Ramah in the italics. And he quotes that as well, that by doing these things, that's how you're kona this world. And then you get to the underlined part, and he adds in, "Umikol makom mutter luma bakrai bishar chachmos." However, you should know that it's still permitted to learn bakrai, means irregularly, once in a while, other wisdoms. Ulvachilo yu sefer minim, as long as it's not heresy. V'zehu nikra ben chachamim tiyul pepardes. And this is what we refer to. This thing between the different chachmos is what we call going into the parties. So it's a little unclear what he means by that, because when he says shar chachmos, we generally assume that to mean like astronomy and English literature, maybe, and chemistry, physics, and history, whatever, right? That's generally assumed. But then he goes ahead and calls it parties. Parties is a Kabbalah term. Right? Is that what he's referring to? So you could go and do that every once in a while? That's what it sounds like, because the way he continues on is, v'ein l'adam l'tal b'pardes rak l'achar shemoli krisu basur v'yayin. So however, a person shouldn't go into pardes, they shouldn't take this trip until they have filled their stomach with meat and wine. Right? V'hu leida iser v'heter v'dini mitzvos. And he knows, what does that mean? That means he knows halacha. I mean, he has to be well grounded in halacha before he could go and venture into this Kabbalistic world, right? Which is really the punchline to why Rabbi Akiva came out okay, right? Rabbi Akiva apparently had enough expertise in Esther Hatter to be able to come out the other side being okay. He was well enough grounded to know that he wanted to come back into this world. So comes the Shach in his commentary on the side of the Shulchan Aruch, and he talks about what Pardes is. And those that have learnt it and those that haven't, right? So the first two lines, the Rambam defines it as being this idea of the Maisa Bereishis and the Maisa Merkava, and then we get to the underlying part. He says, Lepardes, the stories of Arba Nichlus of Lepardes, the Afa Pisha Gedoli Yisov Echam Gedolam Hayu, even though they were pretty wise people, Lukulam Hayu Behen, Koach Leida Ulahasik Koadvarim Alburian. They weren't yet They didn't yet have the strength of knowledge to know all of these things to their sources. Vani omer she'ein roi l'tayl b'pardes, el mish nismali kreso lechem u'basar v'lechem lechem u'basar. Right, and a person really shouldn't go until they're totally full with these things. Lechem u'basar hu leida ha'isur v'hamuter. That means to know what's permitted and what's prohibited and what's permitted. V'chiyotzi behem mishar ha'mitzos. And similar from all the other mitzos. V'yafal pishet varim elu davar katan karu osan chachmei. Right, even though that's the small part. He's referring to a Gemara in Baba Basra, where he says, Amru, Baba Basra, davar gadol maisim rekava, davar katan havayus dabai v'rava. He says, what's the really big thing to know? The really big thing to know is the Maisim Merkava, right? The image of Hashem and referred to as Kabbalah. And what's the small things? The small things is the kashas of Abai and Rava, right? The question, you know, the Gemara that we spend all of our, that traditionally we spend a lot of our time doing, right? So the Gemara calls one big and one little. So the Shach says, even though I'm telling you to learn the little thing, afal pikein, even so, ruyin lahakdiman, that still is what you should do first. Shehemi yashem daito shel adam techilav, as you gotta settle the mind of a person first. Va'od, shehem hatov hagadula sheshbiya kadosh baruch hu liyishiv olam hazeh kedei linchol chai olam habavos. That's the way that Hashem said that's the way Hashem influences this world in order that we inherit the world to come. I mean, rather than focus on how this world might be the world to come, or how, right? Rather than focusing everything on the world to come, focus on this world, which will ultimately lead you, right? If you follow the Torah, that will lead you to the world to come.
Just a question on the remark you just made about it. So, does a Kabbalist think that this is the world to come that we're in now? No,
I don't think so. I don't think so. But he's focused on that. He's focused on how does this fit with that? How does God view the world? Right? What's it going to be when we're there? Right? As opposed to just focusing, okay, what do I have to do here? Meaning, rather than, the way I was brought up, right, through my yeshiva training, is that, you know, as the Rav Salvechik describes in Halachic Man, right, when you see mountain range, to look at the mountain range and see, would that qualify as like an Erev? That qualifies well for an Erev, right? When the sun rises in the morning, oh, look at that. That means that it's time to daven Shacharis. So there is a point of, the Rambam does talk about looking at the creations of the world and saying, you know, wow, that's really amazing, all the things that Kadosh Baruch Hu does, right? But our focus is not necessarily on that. Our focus is on, okay, what do I have to do now today, you know, with my list of mitzvot that I'm supposed to do. Those lists of mitzvahs should be done with kavana and islavos and the enjoyment and all simcha and all that kind of stuff, but it's a focus on what we're doing in this world. So he says, "Gama mekubalim v'shar achonim hifligu b'davar shelo lilmod chachmas hakabala ad achash mili krisum yeshas." Even the mekubalim also say this, that you shouldn't be learning Kabbalah until you finish Shas. The yesha kasvu, and there are those that write shelo lilmod Kabbalah ad shiyehei ben arba'im shana. There are those that say that you shouldn't learn Kabbalah until you're 40 years old, right? Kemosha Kasav ben Arba'im Labina, as we see in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that everybody turns to whenever you're at like a 60, 70, or 80-year-old birthday party, or 90-year-old birthday party, right? So what is 40? 40 is Bina. 40 is understanding. So that's the point, that's where the idea comes from, that one is supposed to wait till they're 40 years old. Dr. Joel Hecker, I asked Dr. Joel Hecker if he had an article on this idea of 40 years, or had anything to say about the 40 years old thing, so he sent me an article that was entirely in Hebrew, so I didn't break my teeth on the entire thing. But just the beginning of it shows a few other concepts of 40 years old is not just this idea made for Kabbalah, it's a Kabbalistic concept. The idea of 40 years old is found in regular places. And there's two sources that he has here that points out Moshe Rabbeinu, Af Moshe Rabbeinu, Lo Ramza Lehen Yisrael Ela Acha Arbim Shana. That Moshe didn't really... Lo Ramza Lehen Yisrael didn't really... like reveal Hashem to Yisrael, or really understand Yisrael until after 40 years. Well, Ramza Lehen Yisrael, really demonstrate this knowledge of Yisrael for 40 years. Shneemar, I mean, till the end of, this is, then he goes on and quotes Psukim from, from Devarim. Vayischanun is his 40th year of leadership of the Jewish people. So he doesn't demonstrate his understanding of the Jewish people until 40 years have gone by. Ve'olecha eschem b'mibar v'imshana, I led you for 40 years, and it says, right, v'lo nasan Hashem lechem leiv, Hashem's been upset with you for these 40 years because you've been complaining and doing all these kinds of things. But he got to know that it took him 40 years to understand that. And Amarabba Shmamina lo kai inish adaiti derabia ad arbaim shana. The person doesn't really attain the knowledge of its Rebbe, of their master, until they're 40 years old, right? So you take, or until they've had that master for 40 years. And then there is the Rambam writes that how old was Avram Avinu when he was able to recognize Hashem? Guess what? 40 years old, right? I'm not sure where the Rambam gets that from. I don't know where the Rambam sources that Avram was 40 years old when he first recognized Hashem. Right, once he realized Hashem, so he started giving all these answers to answering back all these people in Ur Kasdim and having dini Torah with them. This isn't true what you're doing. And that's when he broke the idols. And that's when he started telling everybody that you really only should be serving Hashem. But that was the age of 40. So this age of 40, right, is a general Torah concept. I remember one time we were in Shir, and Rav Shechter made the following. He quoted the Zohar. It says in the Zohar, da 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 da. Says, how do I know the Zohar? I haven't learned the Zohar, but this Zohar was quoted by the Baal HaTanya. So I've learned the Baal HaTanya, and that's what he's doing. And he commented, I don't learn Zohar plus I'm not 40 years old. I mean, I might be physically 40 years old, but I'm not mature enough. Right, and then he goes on, and there seems actually one of the Hespedim, I don't know who gave it, because it's given by four or five Rebbeim from Gush, and it just says who the four are on the MP3. It doesn't say what order they gave it in, and they didn't introduce themselves, so I'm not sure which one said this, but he said that when he the Ramban, right, we're gonna get to it shortly. I was going to do that next. But the Ramban quotes Kabbalah. The Ramban clearly quotes Kabbalistic concepts, and he quotes them in ways that he says, and you know, some people might know what I'm talking about. If you don't know what I'm talking about, then forget about it. It's okay. And they don't translate it in the art scroll. They just leave that part blank. They go dot dot dot, and like the Ramban is off talking about Kabbalah, and don't worry about it. Move on. So this person related that he wanted to. He felt he was older. Whatever, he wanted to go. He wanted to start learning those Kabbalistic ideas in the Ramban. So when he learns the Ramban every week from the Parsha, he's going to do the Kabbalah parts as well. So he figured he'd ask Rabbi Lichtenstein what he thought of this idea. So he goes over to Rabbi Lichtenstein and says, you know, I've never learned I have a confession to make. I've never learned the Kabbalistic parts of the Ramban. And before he could continue his sentence of, and I want to start trying, Rabbi Lichtenstein said to him, yeah, the Ramban didn't write that for people like us. Right, meaning so he was his perspective. He was saying this as saying that, you know, part of Aaron Lichtenstein's humility was that he always saw himself as one of the guys. Right, that was what his purpose was. I said, aha! I mean, Aaron Lichtenstein was also excluding himself from that group that would be going ahead and working hard on those ideas. Okay, so just a brief word about the Zohar. So the idea of a Kabbalist as being a separate entity didn't really exist until the 11 or 1200s. There is an article that you could find online. If you go to the Wikipedia page, it's quoted in several places, and I asked a few people about it if they knew about this, and they kind of said yes, it's written, it's good. If you go to the Wikipedia page and it talks about the authorship of the Zohar, so there is an article that it links to in the footnote entitled, I forgot the exact title, but about the authenticity of the Zohar. And the author is Rabbi Haredi. Right? Meaning he wrote it anonymously. He didn't want this to go around. But it is pretty good. So this article points out that nobody called anyone else a Kabbalist until the 1200s or so, the 11, 1200s, something like that. Now, clearly, the concepts of Kabbalah existed in the Gemara, right? In the Mishnah, right? Talked about Maisim Merkava. You had these Amoraim walking around making golems here and there, right? So there was some concept of being a Kabbalist. There were certainly esoteric areas of halacha, right? But the idea of being a Kabbalist didn't exist until then. Then comes along someone by the name of Moshe de Leon, and he produces something that he calls the Zohar, and he claims the authorship of it was Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, who's Yortzeit maybe tonight. I don't even think I realized that when I scheduled the shir for tonight. I just figured, oh, it's Sfira's Lag BaOmer sometime near then, right? But Rav Shimon, right? So the author is by is he claimed to be Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. Now it's problematic. It's problematic for many reasons. It's problematic, first of all, because there's no record of it anywhere in the Gemara. But besides that, there are things in the Zohar that are quoted from people that lived after Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. Right, there are things in there that seem to contradict things that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai said, right? And it seems pretty clear. Even the Rama himself in the Darkei Moshe seems to point to this idea that the Zohar was not discovered by Rav Moshe de Leon, but really was written by Rav Moshe de Leon. And then, depending on how frum you are, you will say it was all by a mistake. You'll go on the strand from. He was it was all a Masorah, it was all a tradition, or a lot of it was written and some of it was added on, or there was a text that everybody, that only, not everyone knew about, but a few people knew about, and it was added on to over the years, but it was started by Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, and, right, that's one extreme, and really Rav Moshe de Leon just found it and brought it into the world because he felt it was important to bring it to the world. That's the right-wing extreme, all the way to the left-wing extreme, which is that Rav Moshe de Leon just made it up. Right, and decided to attribute it to somebody else. Now, are you an apikoros if you hold the left wing view? Professor Mark Shapiro from Scranton has an article that he published in Hebrew. So I broke my teeth on parts of it. Entitled "Are You an Apikoros If You Don't Believe That Rav Shimon Bar Yochai Wrote the Zohar?" Right. So one can, and there is an English subscript to that that he wrote on the Sfarim blog. Interesting, right? But that is the range with regards to the Zohar. Either it was written by Rav Shimon Bar Yochai and was added onto along the way and ultimately revealed, or ranging to Rav Moshe de Leon, who was a legitimate person. He wasn't he wasn't a crazy guy. He was a legitimate person that had Masorah and had Rebbeim and etc. Right? And the fact that he made it up, drawing on concepts that he learned elsewhere. Yeah.
Professor, conclude about being an epicurus.
Well, the more of an academic you are, the more you're going to, right, because it's not quoted anywhere, right? He all of a sudden reveals it, and nobody else yells at him for revealing it, right? there's little evidence that there was, to go with the assumption that this was some kind of secret book that was passed on only through the, you know, through the elders of Zion, so to speak, right, for a millennium, right, and no one else knew about it, is academically a little hard to believe, right? So, okay, this is what it is. But the Zohar is the most famous and perhaps most accessible and most popular Kabbalistic book. It was perhaps made most popular by the Arizal, right? The Ari HaKadosh, right? Who probably most popularized it. And it is the main, the premise for much of the Kabbalah today. There is Rav Yaakov Emden, who himself was a Kabbalist, and certainly knew Kabbalah, and his siddur is a Kabbalistic siddur, right, and employs Kabbalistic ideas into the siddur, right? He wrote a book talking about how going after the Zohar, saying how the Zohar is not an authentic, is not authentically from Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, although he tries to defend many of the proofs that he brings to make it to kind of defend them as Kabbalistic ideas, right? Okay. One more thing I just wanted to discuss quickly, and that is, okay, so things that are found in the Zohar are things that are found in Kabbalah. So how do they impact us in the halachic world? So there are really three levels that I'll just point out here with three different examples. Level number one, mitzvah lechos hatzitzis biyad smolis keneged libo b'shas kriyashma. In Shulchan Aruch it says there's a mitzvah to hold your tzitzis opposite you during time of kriyashma, remez ledavar vayu hadvarim ha'ele al levavecha, right, by your heart. Right, that's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. Don't say anything about kissing it. right? Comes the Magen Avraham and says, right, being k'mitzel lezeres, right, between your ring finger and your pinky, right? V'chishyagia l'parsha tzitzis yichem biyad yad yamin. Then when you get it, it's in your left hand. And then when you get it, because that's by your heart, when you get up to the parsha of tzitzis, you switch it to your right hand, right? V'yabit bahem v'yu biyado ad shiyagia l'namaz. And you can kiss them, and you can, until you get up to ne'manim v'nechamadim, and then you're going to kiss them, and you're going to drop them. Okay? So that is a so is that accepted? Well, that's pretty well accepted, right? Many people don't do it in the Litvisher world. They don't do it. There's a funny story about that in the making of a gadol, which I'll share a different time. But they there's no real reason not to do it, right? Unless maybe there is. But assuming there's no real reason not to do it, so it's more or less accepted, even though it's a Kabbalistic idea. So that's category number one, where there's nothing wrong with it. It's not going against anything that one would do, right? And it's just a Kabbalistic idea. So we'll add it on to the list of things that we do, right? There's a Magen Avraham that talks about, that quotes from the Zohar, that the Arizal, not from the Zohar, but the Arizal, every morning before davening, he would say, Harei muchen umuzum l'kayim mitzvah saseh shal haftal reyecha kamocha, right? You may have heard that, right? We're going to fulfill the mitzvah of, you know, loving your fellow as yourself. So, okay, there's nothing wrong with that, right? So we'll do it. Okay, we can add that in. So that's concept number one. Concept number two. So the Beis Yosef talks about whether one should wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Oh, so that's always a hot topic. So Shamati, Shemikodim Hayim Anichin Osam B'Chol HaMoed K'divrei HaRash, that originally they would wear it like the Rush. V'achar Kach Matzu, and then they found Shekasav Rav Shimon Bar Yochai B'Maimer Echad She'asu Anichim B'Chol HaMoed V'Al Kei Nimnu Milahanichim B'Chol HaMoada. Right? No, they found that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai in Maimer Echad, probably in the Zohar, right, that he said it's prohibited to put them on Chol HaMoed, and therefore they stopped putting him on. Right, so all of a sudden you have a machlokas about whether to do wear it or whether not to wear it, and then you have Rav Shimon Bar Yochai jumping in, and all of a sudden, oh, he found in the Zohar Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says not to do it. So what do we do with that? So it says the Beis Yosef, he says, well, our Gemara never explicitly talks about it. So mi yarav libo lageshes lavor b'kumase al divrei Rav Shimon Ben Yochai hamafli kol kach be'iser ha-nachton. Right, so okay. So if that's the case, then one can turn to Rav Shimon Bar Yochai to kind of be the decider, meaning one way or the other. We're not sure which way to do. So he'll be the tiebreaker, right? Like yesterday, there was an interview with Buck Showalter, right, who is a manager for the Orioles, who's playing the Mets this week. And Mike Francesa asked him, you know, how do you, now that you're playing in National League Park, does that affect your pitching rotation at all? They said, well, because we had all these days off last week because of the riots in Baltimore, right, so we could kind of arrange our pitching a little bit, so the pitchers for these two games are going to be pitchers with National League experience, right? So he said, how did you do it on purpose? He said, well, I didn't do it on purpose, but, like, once everything is equal, so then that will be the tiebreaker, right? So that's the tiebreaker. So the Zohar could be the tiebreaker. Okay, but then what gets more complicated is one would paskin like Kabbalah when it goes against halacha. So here is a a light example where it talks about when one puts on tefillin. Sorry, ladies, I guess these are all tzitzis and tefillin examples. So that's whatever. But in tefillin, when one puts on tefillin, so one generally puts them on standing up. Sfardim put it on sitting down. So it says the Ramah in that italics part, Yishmi shekasav laniach shel yad miyushav v'shel rosh meumad. Right? There are those that say to put on the shel yad sitting and the shel rosh standing. And who does he quote? The agur, which is a rishon, b'shem ha-zohar, in the name of the Zohar. Uve medinos elu, in our countries in Krakow, lo nagu kein el shtein meumad. Rather, we do them both standing up. Comes the Mishnah Berurah and points out, I am Magen Avraham, Shirosu Lachril, Nacha Shal Yat Yem Yushav, Abracha Tiyem Umad. He has this idea that maybe you'll put it on sitting down and the Bracha will be standing up. Vav Eli Rabbi Shem Marashav, Tshuva Simen, Chaz Demi Lanu Gadol Me'arash Mekin, right? Who are we greater than this person who did the whole thing, who was a Kabbalah, he did the whole thing standing up. And the Biur Grah also chiyach the gam lefi hazohar mutl, and even the Grah points out that even according to the Zohar, it's okay to do it sitting down. Okay. Or okay to do it standing up. And therefore, we shouldn't change the minhag, and you should put on your tefillin standing up, which is what we do. But then the Mishnah Berurah goes on, with that little period on line number 3, and he gives you the rules. Kasav haknesses agdol b'chalei aposkim. Kol davar shebali hakabala vazohar cholkim ima gemara. If the bali kabal go against the gemara v'haposkim, we follow the gemara and poskim. Mihu im bali kabbalah machmirin yish lahachmir gamkein. If there are those, the kabbalists are machmir. I mean, you're not going against anything; you're just being stringent. So then we would be stringent. V'im lo hisker b'gemara uposkim. And if it's not mentioned in the gemara at all, afa pishe nisker b'kabbalah in anu yecholim lachov linokim. However, we can't force other people to do it. V'din she'ein muskar behepich b'shas uposkim yishleach achar tivrei kabbalah v'gam makom sheish plukta bein aposkim tivrei hakabbalah yachria. Right? If it's not mentioned there at all, you could follow the kabbalah. And when there is a machlokes, you could use the Kabbalah to be machria, you could use the Kabbalah to distinguish. So what do we do? What is Kabbalah? So we gave our definition before, right? God's way of seeing the world. Do I need to be 40 to learn it? So, yes and no. You need to have the maturity of a 40-year-old. And to answer Lisa's question about whether I should be giving the class, I'll leave that up to all of your judgments. Okay, thank you for coming, and I'm...